The key thing about what happened to me is we all think we're never going to be that victim. I don't know whether it's sixth sense or something else, but I sort of glanced over my shoulder and I just saw this guy, and he was really scruffily dressed. There's something in me that just thought, he's coming for me. I had to actually look down at my top to see that I was actually being stabbed in the chest.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Life Hacks podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, whether it's the first time or the 50th time. We really appreciate you listening, and we hope you find this podcast free therapy in the same way that myself and Rada do. We chat to amazing people on the Life Hacks podcast who have done something to make their life better, or perhaps to help other people as well. My name's Katie Thistleton. I'm a Radio 1 DJ and I present on Radio 1 on Sunday afternoons from 4 till 7. And here with me, as always, is my good friend and actual doctor, Dr. Rada.
Yes, I am an actual doctor. I do spend time with patients in my clinic and helping them out. But I also love coming on here on the podcast to chat to some brilliant people and also have a lovely little chat with Katie, because she makes me feel better too.
Oh, it does always make me feel good doing this podcast, and I hope you get as much enjoyment out of listening to it as we do out of doing it. Now, this episode of the Life Hacks podcast is all about Natalie Queiroz's story. Now, it's worth saying that there will be some graphic details in this podcast about an experience that Natalie went through. There will also be mentions of suicidal thoughts. Natalie was attacked in broad daylight when she was pregnant in 2016. She suffered life-critical wounds to her major organs and arteries, but amazingly, she and her baby survived the ordeal. She's joining us now, and she's going to tell us all about her journey and her experiences since that life-changing day. She's also going to tell us about how she came to meet up with her attacker and how she now helps to educate young people about the impact of knife crime. Welcome to the Life Hacks podcast, Natalie Queiroz.
Thank you.
We are very pleased to have you on the podcast today, Natalie. Rada came across you on Twitter, came across your story, and we wanted to talk to you about all of the work that you do to tackle the rising knife crime. We're going to talk about that a little bit later on in the podcast, but first let's talk about why that's something that you are so passionate about. So can you tell us about the experience that you had of an attack in as much detail as you feel comfortable with?
Yeah, because the weird thing is we talk about how I work with knife crime now, and yet 4 years ago, if you'd said to me you'd be doing this in 4 years' time, I'd have gone no, because it's nothing about my life. And I think that's kind of the key thing about what happened to me is we all think we're never going to be that victim. So March 2016, so nearly 4 years ago, I was walking into the town centre. I live in Sutton Coldfield, so it's a nice suburb of Birmingham. It was a Friday afternoon, 3:10. So literally, you would not even dream that anything bad was going to happen. I was going to go and meet my partner. I was 8 months pregnant and literally strolling into the town centre, as any of us would. So I was on my way to the bank. And as I approached the town centre, I came to this rather steep hill. It's got a part alleyway at the beginning. But when I say alleyway, we're not talking small, dark, dingy, dangerous place. We're talking wide, tree-lined alleyway behind this really nice big church. And I was about halfway down there when I suddenly heard these footsteps coming really quickly. And I don't know whether it's sixth sense or something else, but I sort of glanced over my shoulder and I just saw this guy, and he was really scruffily dressed. He'd got this hooded top on, he'd got his hood up and head right the way down, sort of half running. I don't know why, there's something in me that just thought, he's coming for me. And that's ridiculous, because to be fair, this cut through goes to the town centre, so it could have been someone who's just late to where they were going. But I sped up to try and get to this dead end road, because I thought, well, there's buildings and there's cars and there's somebody walking up this hill, so they'll be able to, I'll be out in the open. But he was right behind me. I could feel him walking behind me. So I stepped out of the way to let him past. And the next thing I knew, he'd jumped me from behind, grabbed me, pulled me backwards into him. And I was convinced I was being mugged, because I thought, I'm 8 months pregnant, got a massive baby bump. Mm-hmm. I've got my handbag. I'm a vulnerable female on her own. And as I struggled to try and break free from him, he pulled a 12-inch kitchen carving knife out. And there was I thinking, you don't need to hold me up, you can have my bag, just take it, just go. But it wasn't my bag he was after me. And he started stabbing me repeatedly in the chest. You think this isn't my life? I remember I had to actually look down at my top to see that my top was ripped, and I was being stabbed in the chest. So it was carving knife straight through the chest, and I could feel it, but my brain was blocking that it was really happening. And he just gripped onto me tightly and just repeatedly kept stabbing. And I couldn't, my brain's trying to make sense of what's happening. At the same time, it's the fight or flight. I'm wanting to get free from him. I can't break free. And I start screaming for help. And the guy who was walking up the hill, he came running. A guy behind the attacker came running. They both jumped on him, pulled him down. But this attacker kept going and going and going. They managed to pull his arm backwards with the knife, and at long last, the attacker let go of me. I broke free. I stumbled down the hill, managed to get to my feet. Adrenaline, amazing thing, got me up. But I collapsed again. And when I came round, the attacker had also broken free, and he came at me for a second time.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was like it was never... I couldn't believe... I sort of was leaning it. I managed to get myself propped against this pillar, this brick pillar, and he was just walking towards me. It was like a horror movie, because I couldn't move. I couldn't get up. Couldn't, in my head, screaming, get up, move. Mm. And I couldn't. And he started... He cut through my wrist. He stabbed me in the stomach where my baby was.
Oh, my God.
And the next thing I felt was him fumbling with my scarf. It was quite a cold March day, and I was putting my head down to try and block him because I could feel the knife against my throat. And within a split second, where am I thinking, this is it? I'm begging with him. I'm saying, please, I'm a mum already. I had two children already at this point who were 10 and 6.
Mm.
I'm screaming, I'm a mum already. Please don't kill me. Made no effect on him. He didn't say anything. And just as I felt the knife against my throat, a young man, 18-year-old, came running around the corner. He'd heard the shouts for help in the town centre, and he'd come running, and he rugby tackled him off me. But he came at me a third time, but there was actually a police patrol who had also heard the screaming, and they came running and arrested him and pinned him to the pavement. But it was 9 minutes.
Oh,
9 minutes,
gosh,
of solid attack.
Oh, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah,
just unbelievable that that would just happen to someone, a pregnant woman just walking through a town centre in the middle of daylight. Mm. Why was he after you? What was his reason?
At the time, obviously, my head was processing, what have I done? What have I done to offend this person? Is this somebody who's got, you know, is it a mental health issue behind this? What else? You know, and they've targeted me. They hate pregnant women. It turned out to be my partner. So my partner, who had left home that morning, my partner who'd kissed me goodbye, who I was actually on the phone to as I was walking down to meet him, he told me he was stuck in traffic. And he wasn't stuck in traffic. He was already in the town centre getting changed into a disguise. And the reason I didn't recognise him was he had four tops on, and the fourth top was a hoodie. And under that hoodie, he had a rucksack on his front, which padded him out. In the rucksack were spare clothes, spare shoes. He had two pairs of trousers. He had two pairs of gloves. He had latex gloves, gardening gloves. And he had a black bin bag even in his back pocket. It was a targeted attack. I was stabbed in total 24 times. The knife hit the outside of my heart, it hit my right lung, my diaphragm, my liver, the uterus with the baby, which was his baby that he'd pushed for, and he cut through the main artery in my wrist.
Oh my
the
gosh.
Hospital said everything was very targeted with where he stabbed me. It wasn't a frenzied attack, it was very, very cold and calculated.
When I didn't know that it was your partner,
no,
and my heart just fell into my stomach when you said that it was your partner. I didn't know that part of the story.
Bobby and I know each other from school days. I was at a girls' grammar school. He was at the nearby boys' grammar school. Friends of mine had ended up marrying his friends after uni. Mm. So this wider group had always stayed together. Mm. Social media brought us together as adults later in life. So about, like I say, a year after I separated from my husband. And Bobby was the one who pushed for children. He hadn't got kids, he really wanted children. And although I'd had two and thought pretty much that was it over for me, I was later 30s thinking, I've probably done that bit. I agreed to have a baby and we moved in together and I got pregnant quite quickly.
And did you have any, were there any kind of signs about changing your behaviour before this happened, or any kind
was
of
was
anything?
He,
that
was
you...
he ever violent to you before?
No, and this is the thing. Because when you put this into a case, you know, it would be categorised as domestic violence,
yeah,
you know, because it's a domestic case, obviously, and it was a homicide within, attempted homicide within a relationship. But there'd been no abuse, physical or emotional, like none at all. In all the years that I'd known, which was that point was 25 years, I hadn't even known being in a fight with a man, let alone touch or, you know, lay a hand on a woman. No control at all, but he'd kept himself very, very emotionally cold, I guess, inside. Not that he showed that to me. Mm. I've got text messages on my phone from even the day before the attack and 2 days before where he's writing, I can't wait to be a dad. It's such an honour. You've done the best thing for me. I can't wait till we're married. And I was getting those messages right up till... But at that point, he knew. It came out, he had the knife 2 days before. He had the clothes 2 days before. So he'd come home two nights as usual and we'd gone to bed. We'd been, you know, obviously chilling out on the sofa, chatting. And the night before the attack, we were lying... Well, I was on the sofa, he was lying across my lap. He was talking to the bump, going, hello, baby, it's Daddy. And yet the car, his car was sat outside with all of this stuff in it, ready to kill me the next day.
How do you even start processing any of that? I mean, there's the physical trauma, there's obviously the fear and what if it'd been someone you didn't even know, but then you have that extra layer of it being your partner. So how do you even start?
And that's the thing, exactly what you say. It sounds weird to say it would almost have been easier if it'd been a complete stranger. You'd find reasons to reconcile it. When, you know, I class myself as a really switched on woman, and I always think I'm really good at gauging people. So to think, this is somebody I loved, somebody that I trusted, somebody I brought into home with my two children, you know, that's a big thing that he was. And the layers of trauma, mental trauma, were huge because obviously I've just, the baby survived, for everybody listening thinking, did the baby survive?
Yeah, good.
The baby did survive. The knife missed her by 2 millimetres. She was starved of oxygen. They did have to resuscitate her. They delivered her while they were working on me in theatre.
How old is she now? What's her name?
So she will be 4 very soon, and her name's Leah, and she's a good, typical toddler. How can I say it? Complete typical toddler. Combine in typical toddler with a very stubborn toddler because she defied every odd to be alive. You can imagine that's really fun. And
but thank goodness.
She had
at
a complete
that bit
will.
Of the story is, you know, there's a happy ending though.
Yeah, she had a complete will to survive, and you know, nobody expected me to survive. We all thought that she'd gone already because the fact that the stab wounds were directly into the stomach, some of them, we all thought there was no chance.
What was the physical recovery like then?
So physical recovery, so I was airlifted out of the town centre, and they were trying to get as fast as possible to, sorry, obviously, A, keep me alive, and B, they're minimising everything else that can happen.
And keep the baby alive as well.
And keep baby alive. And at one point, you know, they'd all assumed. I've learned since that when they bleep the doctors, they actually bleep to expect a dead baby, which a paediatrician told me rather directly, actually, while I was still in hospital. I thought, there's different ways of breaking that news. Could have been a bit more gentle with that. So they operate on me for 5 hours. As soon as they airlifted me, they got me to the hospital, straight into the theatre and put me into a coma. And the next day I came round and, as you can imagine, my right lung had fully collapsed. So I got a chest drain in my right side. They got a chest drain in my left side because there was a lot of fluid on that side. He'd cut through. When he went through my wrist, he actually took the nerves and the tendons out. So I actually couldn't feel my left hand at all. And I always remember not noticing that at first and then lifting my arm in hospital and thinking, I can't feel it, and almost wondering, God, is it actually there? Because I sort of had to sort of feel around. I still don't have full feeling in my left hand, and they've had to fuse my little finger, and they might at some point have to amputate the finger because it's rotating the wrong way and it's coming out of the socket. So it's quite a...
That's ongoing.
Yeah, but you do love the hospital's optimism. So the hospital, when they last operated on my hand, they said... Right, we have to sign this waiver that we might have to amputate during surgery if it goes wrong. Okay. So I'm signing this thing, I can't believe I'm signing a waiver that you can amputate my finger, but it's only a little finger compared to what some people go through. And he goes, but don't worry, you won't notice. I was like, pardon?
And he goes, I will.
When we take it off, we'll take it off diagonally, you'll never notice. I was like, yeah, I will. I really will notice.
I will.
That you've taken
the
finger.
I'm kind of used to it being there.
When I get to 9 and I can't get to 10.
When I'm counting,
When I'm counting, I'm going to literally notice that it's not there.
Well, wow, so, you know, compared to what the, what the outcome could have been for
exactly.
you and for your daughter.
Exactly. I mean, I'm left with, obviously, a heavy scarring. For the purpose of people listening to the podcast, I have a lot of fake tan on. I openly admit that. Yeah, you can see it on my hands. But yeah, I wear tan because I'm still very conscious of some of the scars and things. But yeah, so quite heavy scarred. Again, compared to those some other people, I really can't complain. I've met burn victims alive. And stuff. My left hand doesn't work properly and I do get pain still in my chest because there are 11 stab wounds in my chest alone. And that leaves a lot of scar tissue. And because it went through the ribs, it's obviously then catching on various organs. So...
I mean, it's actually just a miracle you're alive.
Precisely, yeah. And the hospital really don't know. Even the hospital don't know how I'm alive. Even the air ambulance crew, and one of them was a military doctor, Dr. Ravi, who was on the helicopter, and he's gone out to war-torn places as the doctor. So he's seen all sorts.
Yeah.
And even he turned around and said to me, the angels were with you that day because we do not know how you were alive. My blood pressure was... They put me in a land ambulance first while the helicopter came in. And even in the land ambulance, my blood pressure was dropping to literally, it was just above what should sustain life. And I'm 8 months pregnant as well. So they're thinking.
So you need even more of that blood supply.
Yeah. And that's what they thought. They thought she's going, they didn't think I'd necessarily make the flight.
It's a miracle that you, and even more of a miracle that your daughter survived as well on top of that. I mean, that is an added complication in that kind of situation, isn't it?
It is.
And it's really changed your priorities in life in terms of how you look at things, actually.
It does, because actually, I used to work for a pharmaceutical company and I was very career. I obviously had my kids in my world. My kids are even more of my world now because actually when I was on the hill, they were giving me first aid because the police were on the scene giving me first aid while we wait for the ambulance. And I remember literally, it's a weird thing of feeling the life drain from you. So when people say you feel a life drain, it literally did. And I remember at one point everything going sheet white. Now, I don't necessarily buy into this whole going down a tunnel business.
Yeah.
I know lots of people, there's mixed evidence.
But maybe must come from somewhere.
Yeah, whether it's your brain sort of working. But at one point, everything went completely sheet white. And the the police officer who's pressing on my chest to try and stem some of the bleeding, I remember saying to her, because she was only like a matter of a couple of feet in front of my face, I remember saying to her, Cassie, I can't see your face. And getting quite panicked because it had gone bright white and she was like a black outline. And I was going, Natalie, stay with me. I'm going, Cassie, I can't see. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm actually going to die. You know, thinking I'm going to die on a pavement. And the fear of that and thinking about my kids being without me, my kids only being 10 and 6 and growing up without their mum. Almost overtook everything because then it's like, oh no, I can't die. And there's an indignant part of me that thought, you ain't bloody dying on a pavement. You've not got to 40 years of age to die on
a
pavement.
Not in the town centre.
This is just too tragic. You're not doing that.
This is not the way I'm going to go.
And all the time in the helicopter, I kept thinking about my kids. And it really drove home that actually the mother instinct in me overcame everything. So when you talk about different priorities, my children were always at the forefront of everything, but even more so now.
Yeah,
because it's all about them first and... Now I've got three of them.
Quite interesting stories around, like you say, like near-death experiences and actually how people's thoughts and their priorities and what they go to is their sort of motivation and actually how physically that can manifest itself in the most extraordinary things that when you look at their blood pressure, their pulse, all their kind of physiological signs, that you could think that's impossible that they got up and they stood up and they walked down a hill. But actually there's something that goes on in terms of motivation that makes people... somehow rise above all those statistics and all those numbers in terms of how your body functions, and they actually do it.
Yeah, I've questioned this in my head a few times. I always think, had I not had children already, would I have fought so hard? Would I actually be here? Because they were my motivation. And, you know, and I'll be honest, you know, you ask about how I was afterwards, you know, I was put into a coma. I came out of the coma the next day. The police then told me the horrific news that... you know, it was my partner who's under arrest. So everything's fallen apart. 24 hours, life has blown up and gone into this absolute black hole. And there were times I really wished I hadn't survived. And, you know, when people talk about suicide and we talk about suicide awareness and things, and some people, you know, like, oh, why do people commit suicide? It's so selfish. No, it's not. because it's not actually sometimes, it's not about people wanting to die, it's about people not wanting to live another day with whatever pain is in.
No one really wants to die.
Your survival instinct will always be
scared of death the same as everybody, but they don't want to live.
It's just because everything is so awful, and I understand that. I never did commit suicide, but I have to say,
I felt those feelings.
I had those thoughts, and again, my children are what always made me think, I can't do that for my children, and it brought me through. But I always feel a lot of sympathy for people who are in that dark place, because I know what it's like to feel like that, and people are in that place shouldn't be judged, you know. And people do get judged sometimes, and they shouldn't, because it's the most horrific, desperate situation to be in. And I was really fortunate that I had such a good family around me, and I had a great psychologist who helped me get through that. But not everyone's got that.
Oi, big boy. Greg, your radio show is...
Thank you, Gordon.
Radio 1 Breakfast.
With Greg James.
This podcast is a daily bit of nonsense.
Come and give us your unpopular opinion.
I believe that dinosaurs did not exist.
Oh, come on.
Greg James.
If it sounds like your thing, then download it from the BBC Sounds app. That sounds fancy, doesn't it?
So obviously the police, when you're in hospital, then told you that it was your partner, and you said that you'd kind of blocked that information out a little bit. At what point did you start to come to terms with the fact that your partner had done this to you, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, do you know, that took so long.
Because you presume you loved him, you presume you're having a baby. I can't really comprehend, like, you know,
going from that situation to the total extreme.
Yeah, how do you go from being in a loving relationship with someone, you're having a baby with them, and they've never been violent towards you before, and then out of nowhere they've tried to kill you in such a brutal way? It's just unfathomable, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly that, because I, at first, it's like my head was trying to comprehend two different people. So I was still very much in love with the man who'd left home that morning. It was like he died. To me, it was like Bobby had left home that morning and he died. And so it was like
the
a grief.
You knew, all the image you had of
and
him.
And in fact, he had died, you know, because everything I believed of him
was gone.
So there was like a massive grief, like a complete grieving process. And it was literally the whole typical grieving cycle, you know, the sort of denial and then, you know, going around with the upset and the anger and everything else. But then I was trying to accept who this man on the hill was, that the man on the hill is still the same person who left home that morning. And even when we went to court, he did plead guilty. He wouldn't look at me when we did sentencing day, which was when he was brought in. I still was really struggling because my head was screaming out to him, look at me, I want to get some form of connection here to understand why you've done this. And in court, it's all put down to his family pressure, cultural differences, and he felt so pressured. And I was thinking, no, I don't buy this. That is not just why you've done it. This was too planned. He said he temporarily lost his mind. I even visited him a year after the attack. So I pushed and pushed. I said, I want to face him. He hasn't looked me in the eye.
That's a brave thing to do.
Yeah, and it was a really hard thing to do, because you can imagine the probation service said to me, we don't normally have victims of attempted murder wanting to see the actual person who tried to murder them. I was like, and they're actually
We've talked about it on Life Hacks before, though. I can't remember the name of it now.
Restorative justice.
And it can be really helpful for victims, can't it?
Massively helpful.
To let it go and to try and understand and let it kind of, like you say, fade into the past, as opposed to it being so much of
a
present.
And it was a huge fight. I mean, in this country, I still think there is a sway of protecting sometimes more the perpetrator, because it was all about what would be the mental damage to him if I went in, and rather than, well, what were the mental health benefits for me as a victim trying to, you know, come to terms with it.
Just so we know, what was his sentence?
So he got 18 years. He pleaded guilty to attempted murder of me, attempted child destruction of our baby. He had two assault charges against the men who tried to help me, who got injured, and carrying a knife in public. So he actually had a lot of sentences. Again, frustratingly, they then run concurrently, which I still find hard to get my head around, that you could commit five different crimes in effect and you're only serving the sentence for the longest one.
Yeah, yeah.
So 18 years, minimum 12. So
what was that like, going to visit him a year later?
So a year later, I pushed and pushed and pushed for it. He did agree to see me, that he would face me. I went into HMP Birmingham, where he was still being held. I was taken right through to the centre of the prison. It's something like having watched Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. It was a bit like that, with the big sliding strange metal moment. Doors. Yeah, completely not my world. Never been into a prison before. And they walked me through, and I remember my heart pounding because they showed me the room I was going to meet him in first. It was right in the middle of the prison. It wasn't in the visitor's block. This was actually in the prison itself, an offender rehab room. And I remember sitting, and they said, "Would you like a cup of tea, Nat?" It's like, and I remember going, "Yeah, that'd be lovely." Yes. And I thought, Nat, you're not watching Countdown or something with your grand.
You're not watching a crime drama. Yeah, this is your crime drama.
Oh, yeah, that'd be lovely. I'd love a cup of tea.
This is your life.
It's so British, isn't it? I'd love a cup of tea.
Tea solves everything, yeah.
And that's why, you know, while we go and fetch the man who tried to murder you, would you like a cup of tea?
Yeah, oh, yeah, that's very strange.
That'd be great. Thanks for that. And they brought him in, and I remember hearing them bring him in, and my heart was literally pounding, thinking, I'm in the same building as him here for the first time. And we were in quite a small room, him and I opposite each other. He wasn't handcuffed. People said, was he handcuffed? I was like, no. He had two prison guards behind him. I had two probation officers who'd come with me. They situated me by the door because they have it as a safety policy that should he jump to go for me or whatever, then they can get me out of the room quickly. And I went in, I spent a whole day pretty much there. We had a couple of hours talking, we had a short break, and then I had another couple of hours. And I treated it like a business meeting. I think that's the best way my head could deal with it. So I took an agenda. the business
was quite helpful though, because it again was. In that moment with all those emotions and that kind of all those anxieties and feelings about what happened, and potentially kind of, you know, you mentioned PTSD, potentially some of those symptoms coming, you probably needed that list and that kind of logical approach to actually make sure you got what you wanted to get from it and not leave without any questions.
That was it. It's exactly it, because your brain could easily just go blank sitting there, or you could go off on a tangent, which would be quite easy. And I needed to keep, for my own mental health and sanity, was to try and keep a degree of control. And I thought, well, if I write bullet points, if I write a list of questions, then I'm in control. And I took photos of my injuries, and this is where things start to fall to place. People said, did you get the answers? Did you get answers why he did it? And I said, he still couldn't give a proper answer. But what I did get, his actual non-verbal thing. So the fact that he actually acted quite detached.
Did you get any advice from your therapist or anyone who was supporting your mental health before you went to see him? Because obviously you mentioned about PTSD and having a psychologist. And
yeah, my psychologist was brilliant. We literally talked through the day and about grounding methods and things that I needed to do. And I had agreements with the two officers from the probation team. They were brilliant. They were so supportive. And they talked to me about, well, do you want a safe word? That if you say something, we'll know that we need to get you out of the room. And
did meeting him help with the PTSD symptoms?
I think it was more helpful for me just to try and put some pieces together rather than the symptoms, because I actually had quite a lot of flashbacks afterwards from seeing him, because he was suddenly a real entity again. So he's gone from being almost dead in my head because he's gone to he's a real entity. The best thing for my PTSD symptoms was I did something called EMDR, the rapid eye movement, desensitization. And it's horrific for people who don't know. You do almost like, it's like a hypnosis type of thing, and you go back through the attack. And it's so vivid that it literally made me relive it. And then that's when my head started to process.
I've heard really good things about that, that it really helps people with PTSD.
Yeah.
And tell us about the work that you've got involved with to tackle the rising knife crime since. What made you want to get involved with that?
Yeah, that all happened completely by chance. So we go back to March last year, and so almost on the third anniversary, and a school contacted me who'd seen my stuff through Twitter, and they said, and this is a pupil referral unit, so these are kids who've been excluded from mainstream education. They said, would you come and talk to our kids about what it's like to be a stab victim? I was like, okay. Now, I started doing motivational speaking at this point, so I was used to talking about the attack and talking about it all. And I thought, I don't know how these kids are going to respond to me. They're going to look at me. I'm 42 years of age at this point, and actually, I'm lying. I think I was 43. And, for media purposes, I can say 42.
Yeah, show his age.
I'm lying. I was 43. And I thought, they're going to look at me thinking, she's a 43-year-old woman from a fairly posh part of Birmingham, as it would be perceived as. What's she going to say? And I think when I first walked in, they did think that. And I started chatting to them. And as soon as I said, I'm the victim of multiple stabbing, all of a sudden all of them listening.
Yeah.
And they stayed engaged. They asked loads of questions. And the impact was huge. And I got letters from them afterwards and follow-up things of, this has really made us think about carrying a knife, what the reality is.
Mm.
To have somebody who's actually been stabbed talking about it, what it feels like, what were your injuries, why are you alive, how could it have been different, you know, if any factor had changed, you know. And it's true, if I hadn't been airlifted, I wouldn't be sat here now talking to you. I would have died if we'd gone in a land ambulance. It's a fact. I would have
an element of it is luck. There's
massive piece of luck. And I talked to the kids about, well, think about if you were in a park, how long till someone gives you first aid, how long till the emergency services there, how long till you get to a hospital. So each one of those things could be the difference between this, you know, this is
life
real
or death,
and some kids. The BBC did a great documentary. It was about knives in the classroom. I think it was a panorama. And I remember watching that, and there's always stuck with me that a girl that was interviewed on that, she turned around, she goes, well, we're desensitised to it. And this was, I can't remember how old she was. She looked about 14, 15. And I think, crikey, for a start, they see that. And it's true. I think they are desensitised to the reality of carrying a knife and what a stabbing means. And what I try to do is, I've now got a community interest company, not-for-profit, and I go into these schools, go into these referral units, tell them my story, tell them the reality. We talk about making positive life choices, that even if you're, even if your environment's bad around you, you can still make a positive choice. And, you know, I reflect back and say to them, I was in an absolute hellhole after my attack. Everything was horrible. I could have sat on the sofa, I could have cried, I could have felt sorry for myself, I could have not taken part in the wider community ever again, because I could have just said, you know what, justifiably, I'm going to feel sorry for myself. But I didn't. I made the choice to do something else. I said, and all of you can make that choice. It doesn't matter what goes on around you. It's all about how you react to it. And it's gone down really well, really, really positive response. I'm doing more and more talks, and I'm even going now, some from the Midlands, but I'm now going down to parts of London to give talks. And I do a lot of stuff with the air ambulance. So I've got contacts there. And
that's fab.
That's brilliant. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, you're doing loads of great stuff there, definitely, for young people. And has that helped you to talk about it as well and to give a bit back there?
Yeah, because one of the things, my psychologist, my mum, you know, we're all a bit concerned of, like, how you're going to be talking about the attack, you know, you're having to talk about it for a living type of thing, you know, that you're doing this with your community interest company. But I've got a safe way, as you probably understand, Dr. Rod, your brain creates a safe way of talking about it. But and actually it's helped, because when I see that it's having something positive, nothing will make it worth what happened. Nothing's going to ever be, well, okay, it's worth it. But it really does at least compensate a bit that this is really awful. But actually, if this is having a positive effect and I'm able to do something and feel there's a positive outcome, yes, you know, selfishly it does make me feel a bit better.
It probably also helps you feel better, because you are then taking a bit of that power back, that control back. And, you know, it's that kind of phrase of, you know, like you said before, the victim support, and you felt like a victim.
Yeah.
Obviously you were a victim, but then it's about how you translate that mentally into your head to actually then take it forward to being someone who's got more of the power back.
Yeah, because I never did want to be the victim. So it's really hard at first when you are, and, you know, you are so vulnerable.
And you're not used to being.
No, when you, like, you know, like I said, I was 40 years of age, I was so independent, good job and everything. And all of a sudden I was like this vulnerable child again. I always remember when I was lifted into the air ambulance, there was a community police officer that helped lift me. And I happened to bump into him, and he was chatting, and he goes, oh, you're that lady, aren't you? He goes, I was one of the people who helped lift you in.
Oh, wow.
Cheeky bugger did say, well, it took six of us to lift you. And I was like, whoa, hang on a minute.
Hey, you were 8 months pregnant.
I was 8 months pregnant, and don't knock a girl when she's down. I mean, you don't have to, how many it took you. But he said how the air ambulance doctor spoke to me as they were lifting me in, and he said, I've never seen a grown adult look like a small child like that, because he said, you literally looked at this doctor and you were just nodding, big eyes, taking everything he was saying. He goes, and it was like watching a child, even though you were a grown adult. And I did probably go to that very vulnerable stage, and then I was like, oh, no, this isn't comfortable with me. And as you rightly say, it's taking the power back.
Yeah.
Well, it's an amazing story, Natalie. Thank goodness that you survived.
Incredible.
and that your little girl did as well, and that there is a happy ending to that story. And well done for seeing your psychologist and doing all of this great work, and for other people, but also for yourself, to try and get your head around what happened to you and how sort of a partner can do something like that to you.
Yeah, because I do have to say, anyone who has suffered trauma, and there's a lot of people out there who have, please look for support, psychologist support. I've had it for 3.5 years, and it literally has been the difference between my mental stability. It's not weak to have that support.
Just definitely not. Yeah. Definitely not. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And don't worry about those scars. I mean, God, I don't think you need to be self-conscious about them. I probably need to worry
about the fake tan.
No, not at all.
You look beautiful.
You look beautiful, but yeah, that's the definitely not something you need to worry about when the alternative could have been so much worse. Couldn't it? It's absolutely incredible that you survived. You're very strong, clearly, physically and mentally. So well done.
Very lucky.
Thank you so much for listening to our Life Hacks podcast. We really couldn't do it without you joining us and hearing the amazing stories that we share every week. It's not just us you click on and listen to every week, and we know that, and it makes us super happy that you choose to spend your half an hour with us. And we're always after more people to listen. So if you want to help us do that, then please leave a rating, a review, and make sure you click the subscribe button. These are all things that will help us spread the word about these amazing stories. So join us in our next episode of our podcast when we're chatting to another brilliant person who's hacked their life to make it better.